I'm your host, Juliet, and I'm here with my co-host, Teresa.
Hi.
And you're listening to Mind the Gap. Mind the Gap is a podcast dedicated to discovering the minds behind health, rehabilitation, and neuroscience researchers. So sit back, relax, and please, mind the gap. Today we are here with a professor in the schools of physiotherapy and biomedical engineering, Dr. Cheryl Cozy.
Hello, everyone.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, first of all, I'm a native Haligonian. I'm the youngest of a family of four, and I have three older brothers. I really enjoy sports. I always wanted to play hockey, and finally in grade 10, I was able to play on a girls' hockey team and then played through university, and I still enjoy golf, tennis. I like children, spending time with children. I did that ever since I was young, and I also love animals, particularly dogs and cats.
I did not know you were a native Haligonian. That's very cool. I think we were just chatting about this the other day, about how to call yourself a Haligonian, you need at least 10 years in Halifax.
So I've had a few more than 10 in Halifax.
Yeah, I'm still counting months on my fingers, so haven't been here for very long.
I think I've reached the 12-year mark.
Okay, nice. And I actually also have three brothers. I didn't know you were one of four siblings.
Exactly.
Yeah. Except I'm not the youngest. I'm the second youngest in my family.
Yeah. Well, it was an interesting spot, and they really did have a huge influence, I think, on my life growing up, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you get to play hockey with them?
No, they would only let me referee. I was a very good skater, and like when they would play pond hockey and those types of things, then I got to referee, and that's why I wanted to play so bad. Yes.
Yeah. How about you, Teresa? Do you have any siblings?
Yes, I have an older brother, just one. It's funny, when you're younger, you're like, no, I don't want any more siblings. But then as you get older, it's like, I wish I had more siblings.
Yeah. All right. So one thing that we do on this podcast, we have a kind of introduction segment just to get to know you a little bit better. So we ask first date questions. Teresa and I pick them out ourselves. So hopefully you'll like these. Starting with, what is something that you are most proud of? And in this context, outside of the work you've done?
I would say the thing that I'm most proud of is being a mother to my two children, William and Sarah, and having them grow into very lovely, responsible, caring individuals, and just being able to, I guess, provide them with opportunities that they both really grasped onto and have done well, but both of them are very, I would say, productive and caring individuals.
Aw, that's so sweet. I don't think I can say anything to beat that answer.
Yeah, I feel like parenting is not from experience. I'm not a parent yet, but I feel like it would be such a rewarding process.
Yeah,
it is. And really, like when I was, it was something that I never thought of. You know how people, like some people think, oh, I'm going to get married, I'm going to have kids or whatever. And it was just, you know, not something that I planned or any of that type of thing. But I enjoyed my time with my children. I still do. We make sure we get together. One's in the Czech Republic, the other's in California with my two grandsons and et cetera. And it's tough, but we make sure we get together almost three times a year.
Wow.
Yeah. My mom has four kids, and we all decided to go somewhere completely different to make it really hard on her. Just kidding. But we do call often. I was just on the phone with her this morning, which was quite nice, especially since she's like 4 hours behind. So it was really early for her.
It is. It's tough to juggle because Sarah's 4 hours behind and William's six ahead, right?
Oh, wow. So it's like if you're doing a family call.
It's hard to find time for that, yeah.
So our second first date question for you is, outside of work, what are some things that you enjoy to do in your free time?
So I have always been extremely active. So I like to do active types of leisure activities. So basically, right now I do a lot of golfing. I used to play a lot of tennis and do a lot of running, but I have some issues with my joints, so I can't do that. So golfing in the summertime, I do a lot of walking. I walk with friends. I have friends that I've walked with for, you know, since 1981.
Wow.
we ran half marathons and stuff, and then we will still walk. And others that are, you know, maybe 20 years and that type of thing. So I enjoy doing those types of things and spending time at my cottage in the summertime as well, and doing things like paddleboarding and those types of things. And then I like to travel.
Yeah. Those are all such fun things.
Do you think your kids got a travel bug from you and that's why they kind of are?
So my son definitely, because he's really, he's done a lot of traveling. My daughter, she likes to travel as well, but most of her traveling had been related to school and sports. Like, she was heavily involved in high-level soccer and basketball. So she did a lot of traveling through that. But she does enjoy traveling. And next year we're looking at some type of a family vacation in Europe close to, you know, so that she could go visit William as well. But bringing her kids, et cetera, and spending some time in Italy or, you know, Spain or something like that, and then visiting William in the Czech Republic.
Oh, that sounds so fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a question and I completely blanked on it. Well, that's okay. I can move on. So our next question is quite a big one, so you can take some time with it. But briefly, can you give us a recap on all the major milestones that you've accomplished in your research journey? So, I mean, anything can be considered a major milestone, but I'm thinking like degrees that you've completed and universities that you've worked at, mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Okay. So I guess milestones, the first one would be likely in high school, where I had a physical education teacher who actually did a section on kinesiology in our health education component. And I got really interested in the whole idea of muscles and nerves and like how people moved and that type of thing. So I figured that that's what I would want to do, is something in that area. So I went to the University of New Brunswick and I started in education, physical education, and thank goodness in first year I got to go out student teaching and saying, oh my god, there is no way I can do this. So then I had to switch gears, and they had a program that was sort of a precursor of a kinesiology program that I entered, and that's where I really became interested in biomechanics and that type of thing. So that's where I had my first degree. Hmm. And then I figured, okay, I'm not ready to do anything else. I think I need to go on and do a master's degree. So I looked around and all my friends were going out to Alberta. So I applied there, but I also applied to some Ontario universities. And I chose the University of Waterloo at the end. And I am so happy that I had made that decision, because I graduated from the University of Waterloo. And I think the opportunities that were given me there were actually key in my development because I worked at Wellesley Hospital in Toronto like 2 days a week in my second year. And I got interested in, you know, working with physiotherapists, occupational therapists, like doing research and helping them with their research. So I think that helped me actually get the position that I got at Dow in the School of Physiotherapy initially. And you have to remember at that time, there were no faculty members in the School of Physiotherapy who had PhDs. So anyway, I took that position. And so that was a big sort of step. But then I realized, I said, you know, to do what I want to do, I need a PhD. So I was going to do, you know, look around. I thought I might go back to the University of Waterloo. But then when I had spoken with one of my former professors, who was kind of the godfather of biomechanics in Canada, David Winter, he said, no, he says, you've got two small children. You have a house. You can't just get up and move. And he said, why don't you do this? And suggested that I look into the physiology biophysics program here at Dow. And the only person there who was really doing something similar was looking at ECG signals and electrocardiology of the heart. But we worked out sort of a plan for me to do my work on the heart, but learn all of the statistical pattern recognition procedures that I would then use later to do the work that I wanted to do. So it ended up being like, at first I thought, oh, I don't know, because it was taking me away from my interest in sort of musculoskeletal health, but it was probably a very, very good learning experience that did impact my career. So I did my PhD here in physiology and biophysics, and then a couple years later, a new faculty member started in the School of Biomedical Engineering, and that's where sort of the Dynamics of Human Motion Laboratory was sort of born, was through that collaboration, and really begun the work on osteoarthritis. So I'd say those were the big milestones with respect to education, and then being honored with the career award from the Canadian Society for Biomechanics was probably another something that was a milestone there.
That is such an interesting path to take. I mean, I also did a degree in kinesiology, and I also have a very strong passion for biomechanics. So it is really interesting. And I did actually look at all of the master's programs offered at the University of Waterloo as well. And they all looked really interesting.
Yes.
And I ended up coming to Dalhousie, which I definitely do not regret. But it is just such an interesting field of research. And then, yeah, I didn't even know that there was a PhD in, sorry, did you say physiology and
biophysics?
Biophysics.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And they're in the Faculty of Medicine.
Okay.
And I, you know, there would be some individuals who would do some neuro work in that area, but I think you chose very wisely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's an important point, too, that while you were doing your PhD, more so looking at the heart and cardiology, there's a lot of transferable skills. Because I know there's like other people in the faculty who maybe they started out doing their master's or PhD research in an adjacent area, but you still have all those skills from the statistical analyses and everything else that can transfer over, and you can end up doing what you want to do in research.
Yeah, exactly. And the basic electrophysiology part of it and all of those types of things. And I think that sometimes people get too narrow.
Yeah.
In their focus. And there's a lot of pressure, I would say now more so perhaps than at that time, to really say, oh, you can't deviate from this path. But I'm not sure that's true. I think that if you learn those skills, you can transfer those skills to a lot of different applications and areas of study. And so many things now are team science.
Mm-hmm. I was reading this popular article recently about like the need for both divers and swimmers. It's a metaphor. Basically, you know, they were highlighting the issue that a lot of people in academia nowadays are really, really hyper-focused. But you need a mix of both. You need people who are going to be divers and dive into the nitty-gritty of specific topics. But you also, there is almost a bigger need for swimmers who do a big kind of lit review of all the specific research that's happening so that the general public and the general research community can understand the topic as a whole instead of just, you know, the answer to one tiny little question. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And yeah. Understand that research projects are just building blocks. Mm-hmm. Like one research project doesn't answer a question, yeah. Or it answers a question, but it building all of those blocks can actually answer a larger yes. question, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that no one study is like the only study that, you know, says that this particular theory is correct or that type of thing. So I totally agree with that, Juliet. Mm-hmm. I like that analogy. I haven't heard of that analogy. Yeah,
I honestly don't even remember where I read it from. But it's probably something I found off of Twitter or something. But it really stuck with me because mm-hmm. I was like, that is true. And, you know, there's other things that you don't really think about, right? Like, maybe my master's is focused on answering a research question, but at the same time, I will be learning how to organize data, how to analyze data, how to interact with participants. Like, all those other skills are things that would go into any other discipline, not just the one that I'm in right now. So
exactly. Yeah. And ethics, like the whole ethics
yes.
protocols.
Oh boy, yes.
All of those, like all of those skills are transferable skills. So mm-hmm. I totally agree with you. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we are wondering, what is the main focus of your research that you do right now?
So the main focus of the research that I've been doing probably over the past 20 years has been on musculoskeletal disorders and particular low back pain disorders as well as knee osteoarthritis. And the reason why I focused on both of those joints, A, is the prevalence of the disorders, because both are off the scale with respect to numbers of individuals and their impact on, you know, health and the economy and that type of thing. But both joints are inherently unstable. And my interest in biomechanics is also sort of complemented by my interest in muscles and how muscles work, the neuromuscular system, and really trying to understand the importance of the muscle when we're talking about a pathology of a structure like cartilage or, you know, ligaments or those types of things. And interestingly enough, like our work was some of the first work done on looking at electromyographic activity of individuals who had knee osteoarthritis. It was all biomechanical work, looking at joint moments and angles and those types of things. Very important work, not to downgrade that, because it is important work. But the muscles are the controllers of joint motion, as well as can help dissipate forces. They stabilize the joint. So that really drew me to try to sort of improve the understanding in that area by looking at both biomechanical and muscle physiology. So looking at EMG patterns during these movements, as well as, you know, muscle strength and other types of measures, and linking those to sort of clinical outcome measures as well. So the whole body of work is really trying to give us some sense as to how function of muscles and joints change as the disease progresses, but also how differences in joint mechanics and muscle activity can actually cause the disease to get worse.
Hmm.
So, right?
That's very interesting.
Yeah. It seems like a big blind spot on previous research because it's, you know, you think of osteoarthritis and in the name you think bone, right? And to not look at muscles is like, but the muscles are what acts on the bone. Yeah, and so
it's like a protective mechanism. The muscles can be used in order to protect that joint.
That's exactly right. And similarly with the back, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there'd be lots of, you know, manipulations or those types of things. But if you don't correct an aberrant pattern, and that pattern is the thing that is, you know, causing pain because maybe it's not able to stabilize the joint or, you know, whatever reason, then you're not really going to get at the root problem. So you're really trying to get closer to, you know, how can we make some changes that could be effective to slow the progression of this disorder or predict who will actually get worse if they don't make some changes.
Yeah.
This kind of makes me think about the fact that I learned this in my anthropology class, but a lot of modern day developments to help with people who experience, say, back pain or pain in their feet as they walk and stuff are developments that take over the role of our muscles. And sometimes, most of the time, what happens with that is you don't have enough muscle strength to kind of support the area that's causing pain. And what's causing the pain is the weak muscles. And then you're replacing it with some sort of like plastic structure. And it's just kind of like a negative feedback circle kind of thing. I don't know if you've come across stuff like that in your work.
Absolutely. So absolutely. And what it is really trying to determine what the cause of the problem is, because sometimes it may be necessary to have a brace or something like that. But there are instances where maybe that brace should never have been prescribed for that particular individual. And lots of work has been done over, I would say, the last 10 years to really get a better handle on that, like that we really can't be saying that there's this one solution for a heterogeneous problem, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's what we've been trying to do. And that's where my pattern recognition work came into play that I did in my PhD, because I could take large amounts of data and be able to pick out patterns from the large amount of data and begin to link those patterns to different, you know, different outcomes. So I do think that, and then even worse than that, Juliet, is that there's many prescriptions. And when I first started in the low back pain area in the early 80s, and it still goes on as well in OA, is some individuals they stop moving because they don't understand that, yes, you might have a little pain, but we can help deal with that pain. And that's goes to your point, Teresa. Then you've got a big problem. If people aren't using their musculature, then you do get those changes in it. It's not just strength, it's in the whole neuromuscular control process. So that does create some issues, and that's something that we've been working on trying to change.
I really like that perspective. I definitely run away from any researcher who thinks that they are the ones that are going to like solve the big question on their own kind of thing. Having that kind of realization that any problem that you're trying to solve in research requires just a multidisciplinary approach to and like it's complex. It's never going to be like, you have back pain? Okay, drink grape juice and you'll be better. Like, you know, it's always going to be more complicated than that.
Exactly.
So
And they lump it into non-specific low back pain often, which is so ambiguous. Like if you went in with a, you know, a headache and someone said, well, that's a non-specific headache, like you would say, what?
Yeah.
but so that whole notion, there is something that's causing the pain. And you need to find out what that is and how can you target some treatments that can actually help that while you help maintain the integrity of that very unstable joint.
So the next question I have for you is kind of related. So I know you've done a lot of interdisciplinary work. And so did you want to talk on some of the collaborations you've done in the past and present on your research topics?
Sure. That's a long one, but we'll give you I'll give you some key ones. So when I first arrived, obviously, I, you know, did some research with some of my colleagues in the School of Physiotherapy on low back pain and ended up doing some work at the hospitals, which were all separate at the time. So we had Camp Hill, we had Victoria General, the Grace Maternity, the Infirmary, etc. So it was fun to try to go through five different ethics boards.
Oh my gosh.
All of which had different standards that they wanted you to meet. So that was fun. So I did collaborations there and then with some individuals in kinesiology where I did. Even before I did my PhD, I got some experience with graduate students with those collaborations. And then sort of a key one would be with orthopedic surgery. So in my first fall in 1981, I met Dr. Bill Stanish, and he was one of my key collaborators and had been all throughout, still is it now. So when we started the whole dynamics of human motion lab, Dr. Kevin DeLuzio was sort of the lead on that one in biomedical engineering, our whole idea was that we would have researchers from different disciplines. So it could be different disciplines in engineering, people in kinesiology, orthopedics, physical medicine, geriatrics, physiotherapy, etc., working in the lab. So then you would be recruiting students from all those different areas, and you would really build this sort of collaborative team. And it was so interesting early on because the three key ones that we had were engineering, physiotherapy, and kinesiology. And each one of those students had a unique skill set that was very complementary. But the physiotherapy student by the end was programming in MATLAB. The biomedical engineering student was a whiz with human anatomy and human physiology. And the kinesiology student was the one who had the expertise in actually the measurement of human movement. And so from the get-go, it was very, I would say, collaborative with students helping each other. And that was extremely important to me. And then some other collaborations would have been with other orthopedic surgeons like Dr. Dunbar, who was more interested in total knee arthroplasty. And so over the years, you know, I've had worked with some individuals who did mostly qualitative types of research and different other clinicians. And it's been very interesting because you have to learn to speak a common language. And what a physiotherapist will call joint stability is very different from an engineer, from an orthopedic surgeon, from a kinesiologist, you know, or biomechanist. So that was the thing that I learned very early. You don't come in and say, oh, I'm the expert in this area and I'm going to help you. You come in and you find out what's the common theme and then develop a common way to communicate with each other. So we know what we're we're both all talking about when we say a certain thing. Yeah.
One of the like sort of language differences that I picked up on recently is our lab focuses a lot on motor imagery, but I learned that in the sports world, it's not called motor imagery, it's called visualization. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so yeah, it's like a lot of athletes use it all the time. But if I were to like talk to them about motor imagery, they would look at me like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And then you say visualization, they're like, oh yeah, no, I do that. So yeah, I found that really interesting. But yeah, it's really cool to see all of these different disciplines come together to answer a single question, but then be able to, you know, benefit off of each other's skills, but then also learn from each other and learn those skills to help them become better researchers all around. I think it's like helpful not just for your own research skills, but then also for interacting with new people that you come across in your academic journey and being able to like recognize like, oh, what I'm saying is the same thing as what you're saying. We just need to find
a different way.
Yeah. Find a middle ground, kind of.
Yes. And that is like that is so important. And I think your example is a perfect example between the sports world and the neuro
world.
Exactly. Yeah.
I was curious, how have you found working with clinicians and surgeons and seeing your research, because I know like you do collaborative research with them, but how do you find seeing it go into practice, or kind of your experience with that, or the timeline? Or
so the timelines are long from where, you know, your fundamental research would actually get taken up by clinicians. But I think that within our group, because we did have buy-in, and I'll talk about the orthopedics group first. We did have buy-in, and there were different activities that would be sort of knowledge mobilization and translation types of activities that you were able to share your information with those individuals, and then like sort of broader communities where your research could be presented at an EMG conference. It could be presented at a biomechanics conference, at an orthopedics conference, and at a physiotherapy conference.
Yeah.
So you could get those different groups that way. And I guess what I'm really fascinated with is every once in a while I'll kind of check some of my citations, and I'm really so interested in who is actually picking up some of this work. And it is clinicians for sure, but also in the veterinarian area, like, you know, in like horse trotting or whatever, by groups that are developing, you know, exercise programs for low back pain. But there's some that are really obscure that you're just like, you say, that is interesting. Yeah. I would never have written that with that group in mind. Mm-hmm. So it is kind of fun to see that. And I think that's where sometimes making sure that the language that is being used, even in papers, is not jargony.
Yeah.
That it is clear and really getting down to like to clearly writing what your key messages are.
Yeah.
And that's hard in your field of research. Like I think as a kinesiologist and somebody who knows human anatomy and physiology so well, it's just like the other day we were talking about the IPL, and it's like, I know what the IPL is, but then it's you take somebody who has no background in the health regions, they're like, what is the IPL? And even if you say it's the inferior parietal lobe, that's still
what does that mean?
That's still pretty jargony. So it's a difficult task, but very important.
Exactly.
Yeah. I do wonder, if the work that you do and seeing it translate into real life practice, if it ever gets frustrating to like know all this information and like have access to information that you know could maybe benefit participants or patients out there, but to know that it's not being added in as like quickly, you know, because it's never going to be a fast transition from research into practical applications. But I remember having a conversation with one of my profs in my undergrad who found it frustrating sometimes to know all of these helpful ways to prevent falls in elderly populations, but to see either like resistance from participants and patients or just like resistance from healthcare providers to take up all the knowledge that he had.
It is frustrating, but I would have to say I guess I've been around for a long time, so I can see that there is movement and, mm-hmm. and changing schools of thought and ways of doing things. And I think one of them was I became involved with on the scientific advisory committee for the Arthritis Society of Canada in 2012. I was invited as a special person to come in because they were reviewing their research program. So then I just became more involved. And at that time, there was a lot of work on looking for the cure, and it would be more molecular, biochemical type of work, a lot of animal model work, etc. And I have seen quite a change now in looking at, yes, this is important. We have to find a cure, but there's not going to be a silver bullet cure for arthritis because it is such a heterogeneous, it has such a heterogeneous etiology. Mm-hmm. So that's helpful. And now a much better understanding of how important movement is. And I think you just keep, you know, messaging these things. Like I was on an East Link half hour question and answer show 3 or 4 years ago. And that spurred all kinds of other conversations with different people. Even I had people calling me on the phone saying they watched it and can I help them? But you know, now that information is beginning to resonate. And even looking at a study that was done in British Columbia, I think about 10 years ago, by a physiotherapist there, looking at the uptake of physical activity as a guide or not even a prescription, but just, you know, suggesting that you do it. Only 29% of primary care providers would even suggest that. And we are just doing one now with a PhD student that I co-supervise with, Dr. Moyer, and it's changed. That number is now changed. So I think that it does take a while. It is frustrating, but I think that you just keep trying to find ways, and they are often non-traditional ways to get that information out, if you really want it to get into, you know, policy or practice.
And get into the care of patients.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Juliet is, as you know, is in the Masters of Rehabilitation Research, and I did my Masters in Rehabilitation Research. Mm-hmm. Now I'm in the PhD in health. Yes. So we are wondering, because we heard you had quite an involvement in both of those program developments, kind of from the ground, like the very beginning. Mm-hmm. We were wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Sure. So when I first started, it was a bachelor's of physical therapy, or bachelor of science in physiotherapy, was the main program for entry to practice. So I guess it would have been shortly after I finished my PhD, so it would have been about 1993, I said, we need to look at some type of a master's program, research program, So my director was very supportive of doing that. So I helped get that proposal put together and presented it to the Faculty of Graduate Studies. It went up to Senate. MPHEC went through all of those types of things. And we got it approved in 1995 and then started our first students, I think, in 1996. Or it might have been, I can't remember the exact dates. But I felt that it was extremely important because at that time you could, you know, I could supervise students in kinesiology or in physiology and biophysics. But I, you know, thought that this was the best thing for the
missing piece.
Yes, that was the missing piece. So it was an interesting time because it wasn't easy, and neither was the PhD, because we were a faculty of health professions, and there was this sort of preconceived notion that all we did was produce professionals for the healthcare area. And so we had some little roadblocks, but we got it through. And at that time, it was for individuals who had a bachelor's in physiotherapy or a bachelor of science in physical therapy, and they could come back and do this advanced degree. And then as time went on, when we changed to the entry-level program being a master's, and that became the master's of physiotherapy, then we had to pivot and say, well, you know, we're only going to have very few of these bachelors. We have to broaden the scope. And that's where we did some tweaks to the Masters of Rehabilitation Research Program, and then introduced the combined program in 2016, 2017. Mm-hmm. And who knows what will come next, but think that the program has attracted fabulous students. We have excellent students. And if we look at where they are and what they do after they leave the program, some go into PhD programs. My first student became the head of physiotherapy for the military across Canada.
Wow.
You know, like you have students doing all of these interesting and important work after they leave. So I'm proud of that program, to be honest. We just did our FGS review, put the document together for that, because you have a Senate review every X number of years, and one hadn't been done since many years ago when I did the last one. But then I was doing some other work in between, not so much in the School of Physiotherapy. So this was, you know, really nice to go back and, you know, get feedback from students and alumni on the program. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really happy about it because that's what brought me to Dalhousie University. And the thought of having a combined master's and physiotherapy degree, I think, is a great idea. I mean, I'm personally not doing it, but it was what caught my attention to the program in the first place. And so without it, I wouldn't have found all the research labs here at Dalhousie or made the decision to move across Canada to come here. So I'm very thankful for the program to be here.
Well, that's good. And we're grateful that you and Teresa came here as well.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, it's like, in order to foster students to go and do great things, you need great mentors. So it's Dalhousie University needs professors like you.
well, thank you. We have a very good group of professors right now. I think things are, we've always had that, but I moving forward, I'm thinking like it's good.
Yeah,
we're in a good place.
I think that when I think about my journey through academia and my goals, I really do want to be a professor at some point. But I feel like probably one of the most fulfilling parts of being a professor is having that mentorship role and getting to see where your students go. once you've had a chance to like work with them for whatever stage in their career they're in. And so I'm sure you have a lot of fun stories. I went to your retirement party recently, and it was really funny to hear people say that they were previous students of yours, and then now they're like your boss or something.
Oh, that's funny.
Not that they really view themselves as your boss, but yeah.
Exactly. No, I mean, this is the whole thing. So I have both the MS rehab research as well as I taught in the entry to practice program for years as well, and many of those students, one of them is our vice president research right now. And then others I'll meet at conferences, and there are professors in Australia working with really good group of researchers, just, and you know, excellent clinicians, like really innovative ideas with how they've developed their practices. And you know, I got an email, I guess, last year with a student who worked in my lab, not as a research master student, but just as a summer student. And she wanted to go back and do an education degree. And did I remember her? Absolutely. And would I write her a reference letter? And I mean, she just did wonders in a small Nova Scotia community with this holistic health center. Wow. So, I mean, it's not like, you know, it's excellent in the research world where people are associate professors and directors of schools and stuff like this, but it's you know, in academia, it's in other areas as well. It's a great, I would highly recommend it, Juliet, if that's your path.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah.
I think, Teresa, are you also interested in a path? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that makes two of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said there's nothing wrong with a job that every September you meet a whole new group of students who are interested in learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. To be honest, like some of my favorite experiences in my undergrad was just TAing courses. Mm-hmm. I landed a TA position that required no marking, though, so that might have made it an especially good experience for me. Oh. Well, this brings me to our last question, and I think it's a good one to kind of to wrap everything up. So previously, we asked you about what you're most proud of outside of work. And so to end off, in terms of your accomplishments in academia, and I know you have a lot of them, so you can list more than one. What are you most proud of?
So I would have to first of all say that it is the mentoring. And that goes for students as well as I've had the opportunity to mentor faculty members, both at our university and at other universities. And for me, that is the most important thing that I, like when I see someone, you know, who's accomplished something and I've had some little impact on that, that makes me feel very proud. I think helping with shepherding the PhD in health program through as well. I was the associate dean research for the faculty at that time. And that was something that we had tried to do prior to finally getting it approved in 2015. And again, you know, there was some reluctance. And I think, you know, having that through, and it was a team effort, and any of my accomplishments are not singular accomplishments. They've been a team effort, whether it be research or the work in any of my administrative services. So I think that's important. And I guess when you're thinking about academia, it isn't all just about the research. It is about the service and how you're helping to move things forward. It would have been such a boring job if I was in the job and did my job the same way I did it in 1981, mm-hmm. and I was still doing it the same way now. I would, you know, like I just wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
It just would not have been fulfilling. It's like I've had all kinds of different jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one component. So I think it's the teaching, mentoring, it's the service component. And then with respect to the research, I think it is building that collaborative community and training environment that I think I'm very proud of. And again, it's with the people that I've got, you know, that I've worked with, who I talked about, Kevin DeLuzio, but also Dr. Janie Wilson, who's in biomedical engineer, Dr. Rutherford Moyer, you know, et cetera, and the orthopedic surgeon. So it's a team effort there. And I think that why I'm very proud of the outcomes is I think that our research has really changed how people are looking at not only what types of data to collect, because we were from the get-go really looking at radiographic information as well as patient questionnaires and all those types of things, which were not all included in research before 2006, for example, as well as there are more studies that are looking at EMG and muscle activity patterns and those types of things, as well as the analytical techniques. Like some of the things that we found from our analytical techniques, people are beginning to say, okay, that makes sense. You can't just take a peak value from a waveform and say, this is the most important peak. You have to look at more information from the data, and we can do that now easier with computational capabilities of computers and different analytical techniques that we have available to us. So to me, that body of knowledge that we've been able to generate around knee osteoarthritis progression is probably the most proud from the research perspective.
Yeah. Those are all great things. It, honestly, just hearing that recap makes me very excited to continue on in academia. Teresa and I are actually going to be recording a couple episodes on like why you should or shouldn't go into research, and we'll definitely write some of those points. Because they're all, it's just so fulfilling in all of those ways. So do you have any final thoughts, Teresa?
I love the point that you said that, you know, it's like you've had so many different careers, even though you've stayed at Dell. And I see that when I look at Sean, and I think that's one of the reasons why I really want to go and stay in academia, is because you can take on so many different roles, and I feel like it will never be boring.
Yeah,
exactly. And if you have motivation.
Yeah.
Okay. And you have a good idea. No one has ever said, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
Right? So to me, anyway, but you have to make your case and say why this would be important. And it really is a highly flexible position that you can have some influence on that position. And if you choose to say, well, I just want to, you know, do teaching, then... you know, that might be one thing. It'll be difficult to get tenure and promotion, but there are now clinical or not clinical, but career instructor streams that you can do and do some interesting things in teaching and changing, you know, just different teaching methodologies, those types of things. So it is it has been a great career. Yeah. Like I have no regrets. At one point I did want to go into medicine, and then I really have problems going into hospitals with the smell. It's not like that so much now, but I can just remember, I thought, oh gosh, I don't think I can
do this all day.
So you know, and for some people, like, that is a calling.
Yes.
Like that is a, you know, something. But for me, I've always been inquisitive.
Yeah.
And I loved learning, and this would be
it was the fit.
This was, and like I said, I love mentoring, and that so this was the right choice.
Yeah, that makes me happy. That that makes me so happy.
Good.
Yeah. Well, it was so wonderful to chat with you today about your career, all the things you've accomplished in the time that you've been in academia, and just to hear about all the things that you're proud of. Because it just, I don't know, it's a feel-good sort of thing to listen about and to reflect on and everything. So thank you so much for coming on today's podcast.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I was very flattered.
Up next, we have recommendations with Cassidy Klein.
All right, everyone, it's me, Cass, and we are back to Get Wrecked today. So I have a few more recommendations for you all. Again, this includes my top recommendations of television shows, podcasts, and different activities or restaurants that I've been loving recently. So my first recommendation is a show that I hope everybody has watched, but if not, you definitely need to give this show a watch, and it is The White Lotus. This show is on HBO Max. There's two seasons, and I tell ya, this show, oh, it's chef's kiss. It is just so good. It's a social satire which explores the complexities of many different resort guests at different locations around the world. So if you haven't watched it, you're missing out, and it's easily one of the best shows on television. My next recommendation is a complete mindless, funny, hilarious, I'm not sure type of show, but it's a great one to watch if you just need something to kind of sit back, relax, and decompress. And this show is Love is Blind. It is on Netflix. The newest season, season 4, just came out, and it is drama-filled. It's exciting. It's so funny. It can always be a little awkward, but it's just a fun watch with your friends, yourself, your partner, whoever. Definitely recommend giving that one a watch if you haven't already. It's essentially about random individuals who are set up in different pods where they're not able to see their individuals that they're talking to. So it's really a blind date and they're not able to see what's going on. 10 out of 10 recommend. My next recommendation is the Armchair Expert podcast. So this includes hosts Dax Shepard and Monica Padman, who host many cool individuals from Hollywood stars to scientists to athletes and anyone in between. This podcast is very interesting and exciting, and I'm always learning something new or learning a new perspective, and I really value the things that I learn on this podcast while also getting a kick out of some of the many funny things that come out of Dax Shepard's mouth. He's hilarious. 10 out of 10, give that one a recommendation.
Well, thank you for listening to our podcast, Mind the Gap. I am your host, Juliet.
And I am your co-host, Teresa.
And this was recorded at CKDU.